I'm, well, sort of, anyway, since what's his name, Adam was in. Right. I said, we're going to come in sometime and bring in a bunch of records and play them. So, like, with those three that we've just played there, I mean, what's so special about all of them for you?
Yeah. Right, I thought all this out and I don't know if I can remember. No, it's just, I wanted to do it first of all because I wanted to actually play some of my own music. Because everyone sort of, it talks to you too, everyone's got their own influences and people that they're listening to, and sometimes it's hip and sometimes it's not so hip. And so I wanted to come in and play some stuff that I remember as a kid. And all those songs I remember when I was a kid, when I was sort of sitting in the front room, my sister would come in, you know, with the, like the records, and like there'd be one batch which would be the Eagles and Bread, and then there'd be other batch, you know, which have other people's names on them, you know, they'd be borrowed records. And one of them was Ziggy Stardust, and the other was the Rolling Stones single. And the Who Live Leads is just something that I, you know, it's a fairly recent invention. And in actual fact, I'm not that familiar with the album. It's more the Who greatest hits that I that I know. But I reckon it was a good version until you started it up there and went into all sorts of diversifications.
Yeah, because we used a live one. But what about then David Bowie? I mean, like Ziggy Stardust, as you say, was the one. But I mean, was that the first you really got into David Bowie? Or were you there in the early days?
Well, no. I mean, Space Oddity. The second version when it was released in 1973, was it?
Something like that. Maybe even later. Yeah. I mean, the first time it was released by what?
1960 something.
69, 70.
Yeah. Well, it was the second time it was released. I got hold of the single. I don't know how I got hold of it, and I learned the words. And also on the B-side with Changes, and something else was on it as well. And I learned the words of that, and I loved that. I thought it was brilliant. And then my sister bought me Ziggy Stardust. And then I went to Irish College up in Donegal, a place called Anagri. And there was a guy there who spent a lot of time trying to look like David Bowie. And he brought these David Bowie records with him. And one of them I remember, you know that song, With Your Long Blonde Hair.
Sorrow.
And he had that, so it was just a whole, there was just this whole revolution. Everywhere I went when I was like 15 and 16, it just seemed to be David Bowie clones, and it's just his music. And it's odd because I was just saying there before I went on the air, that's so progressive and so new, and I think, you know, had certainly had a big influence drumming wise on me.
Yeah, but another thing as well is that, I forgot what I was going to say there. Another thing as well is, okay,
boring.
No, I was going to say something about David Bowie. I can't remember. Oh yeah, what do you think of David Bowie in the last 6 years, say, of the '80s David Bowie, including Let's Dance in the Middle, in that I think it's lousy.
Yeah, I don't think it's lousy. I just don't think it's as progressive as what he was doing like before that.
He's
taking it easy, and like there was a time where David Bowie like was it, like he'd wait for his next record and all that. That sort of passed. There seems to be a new era, you know, in the 80s, like just sort of a blasé thing about like old pop stars, and sort of they can do what they want, and I think maybe he's fallen into that a bit, you know. But I still appreciate, like, when David Bowie brings out a new record, like, I go and buy it, no matter what it is.
Do you think it's a bit strange that when you say that about old pop stars, that, I mean, like, when all these awards are announced last week, like Steve Winwood win and stuff, or the week before it was Peter Gabriel, and it was Phil Collins, and it's all the old sort of, do you think it's a bit strange?
Yeah, but it's like anything, you know, at the end of a sort of a cycle, people tend to like go back, you know, all these Sam Cooke, everything, all that sort of stuff, all back. I mean, it is amazing that those, well, that's not really what you're saying. You're talking about people like Stevie Winwood and Phil Collins. Yeah, it is quite odd, actually. It is quite, I don't know whether they should give it up, you know, just actually give in gracefully, you know what I mean?
Will you give up at a certain age, Larry?
Well, I think if I think that I'm doing it for the wrong reasons, if I don't enjoy doing it anymore, then I'll give it up. Or if somebody says, look, you're getting terribly boring, then I'll have to think very seriously about it. You know, I think a lot of people do, you know, you become so used to the way of life, and you start, you know, things become so cliched and all that. And it's difficult not to become like that. Like, I don't blame people for lowest common denominator music, you know? Because I tell you, it'd be a hell of a lot easier. You know, it would have been great if we could have, you know, written three or four wars, or, you know, I mean, it would have been brilliant. It would have been a hell of a lot, you know, more fun.
Okay, well, listen, now, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to play another one of your choices here, which is from around the same era as Ziggy Stardust. But before we do, I think we'll take an hour break. Will we? Yeah, we'll take an hour break first. No, maybe we won't. No, no, we're not going to take an hour break. We're going to take a song. We're going to take a song.
You too.
So, what are you looking for there, Larry?
Well,
pen, right? Okay, Larry, listen, the thing about it is there's a few sort of exclusives on the programme tonight. And the main one, of course, is the fact that nowhere in the world has this album been played. And we're going to play four numbers from the Joshua Tree of the 11 numbers. Now, first of all, the album is going to be released when? Monday week, is it March the 9th?
It's March the 9th, is what's mentioned.
March the 9th. And the first single is going to be With or Without You?
Yeah.
And that'll be released, what, about 2 weeks afterwards?
I think so, yeah. I'm not sure the date of it. And I'll have two tracks on the B side. And the A side is, what is it? The A side is 45 and the B side is 33.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, well, like, I mean, are you aware of the fact that, like, this album is just, like, for me and for so many people listening to this program, it's just, like, so long awaited, so sort of, when we got the album last week, sort of shaking looking at the cover, like learning off the sort of serial number of the damn thing. Now, I've had the album for 10 days and I've listened to it for, like a million times. So, like, overall, do you think it is fair to say that if the Unforgettable Fire was a sort of experimental type album, that this one is that same sort of thing, but honed down to perfection in terms of 11 great songs? In other words, like, there's not so much doodling, if you like.
Doodling. Yeah, I think so. I think that the Unforgettable Fire, we experimented, we got in Brian Eno and Danny, and we started something. And a lot of it, you know, we didn't bring to its conclusion. And I think on this record, what we've done is actually brought a lot of the ideas from the Unforgettable Fire to the conclusion and more. I think we've experimented and opened ourselves up to a lot more influences than we would have ever done before, you know. Just sort of, I don't know what it is, it's just, maybe it's a growing process where we're not as freaked about, you know, sounding like U2. Like, there was a funny story about Edge was playing this guitar riff. And he said, no, I can't do that, I can't play that. And Bono said, why? He said, it sounds too much like U2. And Bono said, we are U2. You are the Edge, you know? So, like, there was just a bit more freedom in songs. Like, we wanted to write songs, which is something that it takes us a long time to do. We don't write songs easily. And I think on this record, we've done that. We've got 11 songs.
Did the album take a long time to do?
It took a long time to write the songs. And then not that long to record. A lot of the stuff was recorded live in houses like Gage's house and Adam's house, yeah. And, you know. But yeah, the writing of it took a while. You know, as I say, like, we wrote songs, played them, and instead of chucking them out because maybe there was a dance beat to it, or there was a Jimi Hendrix guitar riff somewhere, or it sounded a bit like that. Whereas before, we might have thrown that out. You know, and say, well, look, you know, we can't see this to its conclusion. This time we had the time to actually rewrite the songs, play the song live, think about it, record it, listen to it, and then go back and, you know, put new bits in, which is something we've never had the luxury of being able to do before. And sometimes that can be disruptive, and in this case, you know, thankfully it worked out well, you know. But you read about, you know, these bands spending a year getting a bass drum sound, never mind writing songs, you know.
So what about the last year then? I mean, like, besides sort of Amnesty and Self-Aid and things like that, you've had a lot of time off as well.
Not really, no, there hasn't
been. You've been working on the album all the time.
Like, I think we were off the road for about 2 weeks, and everyone was getting fidgety, and nobody wanted to ring anyone else, you know, so sort of, we let go another week, and next thing everyone just started ringing everybody and said, let's go down to somebody's house and let's write a few songs, or somebody had a few ideas. So we started more or less immediately just with ideas, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, the first track I'm going to play is the last track on side one, which is called Running to Stand Still. Now, Bono was saying the other day that this one could be taken somewhat as a sort of an extension of Bad from the last album.
Yeah.
In that it's sort of vaguely sort of a personal heroine type story,
sure,
from Dublin or any big city.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear it then. This is Running to Stand Still. There it is, the last track, side one of the Joshua Tree, and that's called Running to Stand Still. So, Larry, what about live on stage? You're going to do a world tour. It's going to go on for what, like, well over a year, is it?
Well, we're only booked up for a year. Booked up for a year.
But it might go on longer than that.
It could go on longer, yeah. There's talk of going to New Zealand and Australia in January or February, but we haven't confirmed that.
Okay, well, the obvious question then, what can you tell us about, as part of the European tour, about playing in Ireland?
Well, I was hoping to be able to say we're going to be playing on such and such a date and such a place, but unfortunately I can't do that because we haven't confirmed any of the dates, and it would be wrong to do that. But what I will say is that we are definitely going to play Ireland, and there will hopefully be more than one date. You know, I really miss, you know, playing places like Kerry or Galway. You know, I'd love to go back down there and play some of those places again, but, you know, unfortunately, it's not possible now, but maybe in the future.
Maybe a surprise lark in the park again.
Yeah, you never know.
Okay, well, listen, I was told about 24 songs for this album. So does that mean, like, you really did have an awful lot and it was just a choice of which were the best 11? Or, like, were the other 11 good as well? Or
the other 11 were good as well. In fact, there are more than 11. There are about 20 songs, 20 what we're calling B-sides as such. But what we're doing is, for the singles, is we're going to make them three-track singles. And the things that are on the B-side are not throwaway songs.
Right.
They're actually songs that we spent time and a lot of care with. And unfortunately, they didn't get on the record, because the record was going in one direction, and we put the songs that felt right on it. There was talk from a DJ we know who works in RTE about doing a double album, and we're prepared to take that risk.
Yeah, but I mean, I've met the Four of you at various places throughout the last year, and I said that to everyone in this. When I mentioned it to the Four of you on Wednesday afternoon, the whole lot just fell around laughing. I mean, is that such a funny thing?
No, it's not a funny thing at all. It's just what we felt was that one album or one piece of vinyl, you know, is complete. And this album is hard enough to get into, such that, you know, in some ways there's too much on it. There are too many songs for you to take in. You've got to listen to it a few times.
It's a very long album.
Yeah, it's a long album, and you can miss bits on it. And we felt if you put out two pieces of vinyl, it would just be too much. People would just say, oh, give me a break, you know,
yeah,
leave me alone. Well, that's the way we felt, you know, yeah. And maybe in the future we'll regret it and we'll say we should have listened to our friend Dave.
Well then, in terms of the writing of the album, which it even says on the cover, lyrics by Bono, the influences that he had over the last year, I mean, is it a lot of the things that he has done from, say, going to Ethiopia, from going to South America in particular, those sort of things?
Sure, I mean, he's the lyricist, and he goes to these places, and fair play to him, I wouldn't go to a lot of them, and he feels that, how can you write about a situation, you know, unless you know something about it. And actually, when we were doing the original demos, there was this sort of funny South American feel to a lot of the stuff we were doing. I don't know, just one of those things. And it was then that the idea, you know, or that the, you know, the feelings for South America, you know, is when that all started happening, and Bono felt that he should go and see what was happening there, and then come back and
But again, I mean, talking to Bono the other day about that, I mean, the thing is that, I mean, basically a lot of, like, the second last track on side one is Bullet the Blue Sky, the last track on side two is Mothers as It Disappeared, and, like, they're both directly related, say, to Salvador, where Bono had gone to. So, I mean, a lot of that would have to be, say, in terms of American interviews when you go over there, be very anti-Reagan and anti the American involvement in South America. Do you think you'd want to sort of cool that down a bit and just leave the people to have the songs? Or will?
Well, my personal view is, like, and I said this last night, I was talking to Bill Graham from Hot Press, we did an interview, and at the end of the interview, like, the interview was going in all sorts of different directions, and I just said, look, you know, it's in the music. You know, it's in the lyrics, it's there, it's on record. You can't philosophize about it and go through it. And okay, some of the things have got to be explained and got to be talked about and all that, but I'm not interested in getting into, you know, deep philosophical conversation, because basically this band writes songs, and they're not taking sides in some ways, they're observations. And yeah, of course, you know, there is an anti-Reagan feeling. I mean, show me one person in the world who doesn't have an anti-Reagan bone in their body. You know, so from that point of view, yeah, you know, obviously it's there and it's got to be talked about, but it's got to be talked about from a musical context, not from a political one.
Right. You know? Well, besides the musical and the political, what about the fact that I think that there's more of the, not so much the religious, the spiritual side, say, of what you two are all about on this album than on previous albums? Would that be fair?
It'd be fair to say that, again, it's something that we haven't closed off, said, oh, we can't write about this. Because we sort of said, we can write about anything we want, you know, and we're not, you know, it's not, you don't sit down with something in mind and say, well, we're going to write about this, you know, we're not smart enough to do that. It's like the writing of the music. We don't come in and say, this is the sort of album we're going to make. Because if we were to do it, that's not the sort of album I would have envisaged making, you know?
Okay, well, listen, Larry, let's just get to something completely different, which is, no, you don't normally do interviews very much.
No.
So people don't necessarily know the full details of Larry Mullen's dark past. Mm. Are we going to find out the questions? Let's just start something at the beginning, which is the way you started to play drums, for instance. Now, on a technical level, for instance, there's drummers like, I don't know, just let's say Russ Conkle or something.
Sure.
I mean, like, do you go for that sort of thing, or is it just whatever is in your head?
Well, I appreciate all those guys, Russ Conkle, Steve Gadd, all those people. I know about them, and, you know, you know, you meet them and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, those, they're great drummers, they're great technicians. I'm not, I never wanted to be a great technician, you know. I always wanted to either serve music or let them, you know, like, as in my drumming serve music, or let the music serve my drumming, you know. But, you know, how can I articulate this without sounding stupid? Like, those guys, they play, and, like, their drumming is a feature on the record. They never serve music. You know, it's always, they're always doing something flash. I'm not into that. Mm. I want to play, so if it's a straight 4/4 beat, if it makes the song sound good, well, that's good enough for me.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
have to show off. I'm not, you know, I'm not interested in that. I never have been. And as well as that, I'm not able to do it.
Well, what you were interested in first was playing the piano, because that's what you used to do, like, way back around the age of 9 or 10, right?
That's right, yeah. And the teacher told me that, look, she was a really sweet lady. She said, look, Larry, you're wasting your time, you know. And I said, I agree, because I was sick of, you know, playing the piano, learning scales and all sort of stuff. And I was walking out on that day. Walking out of
where?
Actually, I went to learn in the College of Music in Chatham Row. And when I was leaving, I was with my mother. And the next thing I heard, this clatter, you know, and I said, drums. And I said, I want to play the drums. And my man said to me, oh, give us a break. He's just been kicked out of the piano class. Well, you know, how are you gonna do something like this? It means having to buy a set of drums and going to more lessons and all that. And I kept on at it, playing with the needles and all that sort of stuff. And eventually I went to the College of Music and failed miserably there as well.
Well, like, was it a question of, well, listen, like, from your mother, listen, we'll pay for these piano lessons, but to hell with you, if you're going to play drums, you can pay for that yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It's so, if you want to play the drums, you pay for it yourself.
So what did you do? Did you go out and buy a set of drums, or...?
No, I didn't. I didn't get a set of drums for about 3 years. Mm. I got together, I think it was about £6. No, actually, no, it was my father paid for the first year, and said after that, I paid for myself. So he paid for the first year, and then I paid from there on, and then I came back after, so I was away for a weekend somewhere, and I came back and my father bought me a kit of drums that cost, I think it was like £15, which is a lot of money in those days. They bought me this kit, and that was, you know, that was after 3 years of playing, you know, and it was a like just a heap of junk, but I tell you, it's my favourite drum kit.
So what did you do when you say playing? I mean, did you do it like a lot of the people I know who play drums? Not that I know an awful lot of people who play drums, but those who I do, they just put on a record and you bang away to do the drum thing as you listen to it, rather than sort of learn things from books.
Yeah, well
like I used the Stones and Bowie, which you played earlier, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, I used to, when I started playing the drums, I mean, it was a time of people like The Sweet, you had The Glitter Band and all that sort of thing. So that was very simple drumming. And I used to listen to those records and sit down and actually try and play that. Like, the guy used to give me this sheet music to learn. I could never learn it. I just wasn't interested because it reminded me too much of school, which I wasn't very good at anyway. And so I just used to pick up the records and play them and listen to them through tapes. And I used to watch Top of the Pops and I'd just zoom in on the drum, what the drum was doing, and fly upstairs and copy it, you know.
So, in other words, like, it's not that even that you found it a bit like school. I mean, you wouldn't even want to approach drumming in terms of a learning way, or learn what paradiddles are and all these things.
No, I mean, I know what paradiddles are. Yeah. I learned how to play them, and I hated it. I really hated it, because I was learning how to play what somebody else had done and somebody else had mastered. And I, you know, I could never do that. I knew that. And maybe that was a defeatist attitude. Maybe if I had taken the attitude, I want to be the best drummer in the world, you know, that, you know, maybe I would have gone on to do that. I would have joined the army band, or I would have done that. But I never felt moved to that. I always just wanted to, you know, do my own thing. I always wanted to, you know, do something different. How about not hitting a snare drum, or not having any cymbals, or I always did those sort of things.
Well, you say that somebody was teaching you in terms of, like, the learning of the whole thing, but those 2 years in which you got that sort of education, if you like, you didn't really go for that sort of thing at all. I mean, like, did you learn anything from those 2 years?
Yeah,
with
I did.
That teacher?
I learned a lot. I learned how I didn't want to play.
Yeah,
I learned that I didn't want to be like that. And there was couple of guys that I went to, and they used to have Steve Gadd records, and they'd have Russ Kunkel records, and they'd play them, and they'd have mastered how those guys played, and they'd be really good at it, and they'd give me the sheet music and the tapes of, you know, and that I'd go home and I'd just put it on. I said, no, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. My heart wasn't in it, you know?
Well, the funny thing is then, because like you went on to join a sort of a military-style band,
yeah.
The Colour Guard. Now, I mean, that sounds pretty regimented to me. That sounds as though you really have to have your head together.
Well, I mean, I joined the Artane Boys band, and I mean, I left that for that very reason. It was a reason it was regimented. You had to have your hair short and all that. And I joined the Post Office band, and they were some of the best years of my life because it wasn't regimented. And like I went to many marches, and I hadn't got a clue what the music was about, but I was just going and I was doing my own thing. There was myself and this other guy, Martin Nevins, hey Martin, he was much better drummer than I was, and we used to go on to the rehearsals and the music we set up and all that, and we'd be trying to learn how to play it, and eventually we just said, look, when we go out in the march tomorrow, we just have a goof and see who, you know, see what we can come up with. And we used to, you know, after the march, we'd be marching down the Valley something, the horse fair, and all the older guys, and I said, God, that was great drumming, you know, that music had really working. And we just laughing behind the back saying, you know, God, we weren't even playing what's on the sheet. Yes.
Yeah, but if the truth were known, I mean, one of the reasons you might have joined the Colour Guard was because there were some females.
Yes, that
around
had
as well.
An awful lot to do with it. There were a whole lot of girls in the band as well, which made a huge difference. And,
in what way did it make a huge difference?
It just, you know, sort of was flattering to your ego, you know? You know, you sort of go down there and, like, the drummers, like, got a lot of attention. I don't know why. It's a funny thing, actually. Drummers and vocalists got a lot of attention, which is odd, because usually the drummer's in the back and the vocalists are usually quite ugly. And, but we, myself and this other guy, we got a lot of attention because we're the drummers. You know, things making something to do with it.
You said the word goof there, which is like, that's really all it was for you in some ways. So like, it wasn't really that serious. It was just sort of like, let's get it together and bash it out on St. Patrick's Day and stuff.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. But also, I mean, I did learn things there as well. I mean, I did actually sit down and learn how to read the music, but I didn't feel that I was learning how to play somebody else's music. It was fun and it was exciting. I don't know what the difference is between that and actually learning how to play like Steve Gadd. I don't really know, but it was different. It was a completely different feel.
Well, between that, the Colour Guard and the Artane Boys band, you two was around at the same time. I mean, that had already started.
Yeah.
So, like, what about, for instance, if you say that the other one was a bit of a goof? The Artane Boys band, the rigid sort of way that they made you do it in some ways, was it the fact that, let's face it, you were told to get your hair cut twice in the 1 week?
Yes.
And it was the second time was the last straw, is
that
it?
Yeah, that's exactly
so is it true that you had shoulder-length golden locks, Larry?
This is a myth. Absolutely a myth. Yeah.
Come on,
no, it is true. I did have...
Alley is jumping up and
yes,
down.
Yes, I did have quite long hair at one stage, and I was very proud of it. And it meant an awful lot to me because it was very hard to get, you know, to get anyone to in the house, in my own house, to let it grow down past my ears. So I eventually got it down just about to my shoulders, and I went in, and the guy in there said, "Well, you got to get your hair cut." Got a cut once, and I came back and he said, "Sorry, it's not short enough." I said, "Like this for a game of Cowboys," and it was off, you know.
Well, did you ever play the big gig of the Artane Boys band, which is like half time or lunchtime or whatever it is?
No, I never got to Crow Park. I was really pissed off.
So when you got to Crow Park later on, as you too, does that sort of make you feel?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. It did. It meant an awful lot. Well, you see, I used to go to all the Gaelic matches with my dad, you know, to see the Dubs play, and you know, I always saw the Artane band there, and I said, "God, I'd love to play with them." You know? So second best was like Paddy Safe Brigade.
Yeah.
You know. And it was easier. I don't know, it was easier to do it with the Post Office Workers Band. It was just more fun, you know, it was a bit of crack.
Well then, like as you say, you two had started within. So like you formed you two. In fact, again, talking to the whole band last Wednesday afternoon, Bono said, "Listen, you should ask Adam. Or, I mean, ask Larry there. I mean, like he's the one who's in charge of the band."
It's my fault.
Yeah, it's your band, as he put it.
Yeah.
So I mean, like I'm not going to give that one again about the sticking up the notice on the Mount Temple Comprehensive School, looking for a drummer or looking for a guitarist or whatever the hell it is. But just tell us something though about Mount Temple School. I mean, as an experimental interdenominational school, did that help in the sort of way you wanted to grow up, and it was much easier, it was much looser than, say, a lot of the people you might have known around the country?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, there was a big issue made of the whole Mount Temple thing, and maybe we were responsible for some of it. But,
But let's face it, I mean, like, they did encourage things that people like. For instance, if you like sports, they encouraged that. Yeah. If you liked music, I mean, let's face it, they gave you two a place to rehearse in the school.
Well, it was only two teachers in particular, you know, Donald and, they two people just gave us, you know, a bit of time. But the rest of the teachers just, you know, they weren't into it at all because, you know, your exams suffered and all that sort of stuff. And at the end of the day, you know, there was quite a bit of a, you know, a vibe, sort of, you know, what these guys, all jolly fine, gone away, you know, and learning the music, but when it comes to doing your exams or when it comes to getting your ECR done or whatever, you know, it's not happening. And, like, I can remember being in class, Mr. McKenzie, sorry for forgetting your name, Mr. McKenzie, he gave us this classroom, the back of it to rehearse, and it was just a small room. Like, I remember being in this class, and he was a music teacher, and Bono, Edge and Adam would be in the back having a few cigarettes strumming guitars when they should have been in class. Mm. You know, and that caused a bit of hassle, so it wasn't all plain sailing, but yeah, certainly it helped, you know.
Well then, what about around that time, which was say 77, which was the way you had approached, the way you talked about there, about not sort of learning too much about drumming, but approaching it just with the feel and listening to the records. Now, did you find the same thing was going to happen musically with you too, because of the way the punk thing was going? In other words, like 15 Minutes of Fame, anybody could get up on stage and do it. Just the energy, let's say, that was there in 77. Now, I'm not saying like that was the music you were doing, but just the sort of energy and the feeling of 77 was something that was very important to you at the beginning of you too.
Well, I was young in 77, and I didn't really understand what punk rock was. Because I was listening to, you know, I hadn't got into 70s rock and roll. Like, I wasn't into all the, you know, everything. Everyone was talking about cliched music. That sort of went over my head. I was listening to, as I say, to The Sweet or Slade. Like, they were the sort of bands that happened to me. So I sort of missed out on that. I couldn't really understand what the revolution was all about until 1978, when I actually sussed it. So, I mean, I was the drummer in the band, and that was it. Like, the rest of the guys were gumming for something.
Mm,
you know, really? they were sort of saying, we can get up there and we can do what we want and let's play our own music, and there was all that sort of vibe, and it sort of, yeah, I missed out on that a bit.
But by 78, there was a million different bands around Dublin, and I mean, you had already got to the top of the heap at that stage. Yeah. I mean, there was yourself, Theatrix, maybe one or two more, and that was it. Yeah. So, I mean, at that stage, like, do you find that it was quite easy for you too? I often thought it was a bit, that, like no disrespect, but it's just that nothing seemed to go wrong. It went uphill all the time.
I don't think it was easy. I mean, you know, and I'm not going to try and justify, you know, the fact that you two are successful, and maybe, you know, a lot of the other bands around that time weren't successful. We worked our butts off.
Yeah.
And in particular, the other three guys, like, I was working and I was at school, you know, at the same time. But, I mean, I can remember, you know, eating cornflakes for breakfast, dinner, and like, I can remember pushing the van. All I know is I think we worked a hell of a lot harder than some of the other bands around. And that's not to take away from them. I mean, they deserve success as well. We were lucky we found Paul McGuinness. You know, like, things just fell into place, but I don't think it was easy. And to say it's easy is to take away from a whole lot of the things that had to happen. Like, we didn't have the best gear. A lot of the other bands had much better gear than we had. And not that that matters, but, you know, there were a lot of people a lot better off than we were.
Mm.
You know, they knew things like chords and, you know, things like fret, like, they knew all the words. They were able to use words like gig. We didn't even understand those sort of things.
Well, do you think punk allowed you to sort of, like,
absolutely,
like, learn on stage, which is a great place to learn?
77, I mean, you know, that did it all. And I think it's incredible, you know, it's 1987 now, and like, music is sort of going downhill again. We're sort of getting back in, like, there needs to be another revolution. You know?
Very much so.
You know?
Yeah. So then, like, around that time, all those gigs, I mean, from the Dandelion to the Baggot, I remember in particular there was about four Tuesdays in the Baggot, and it was the last time we played there with the Blades and support. Mm. Like, it looked so really big then. But right in the middle of all that was one gig, I don't know if you remember, in the Project. It was a 24 hours of rock music in the Project. It was called the Dark Space thing. You don't remember the gig you played about 3 in the morning there, do you?
I do, yeah, I remember it well.
No, it was that one in particular.
The stripper,
I
remember her?
No, I don't remember.
You missed the stripper.
I had to sleep sometime. I was not sleeping at that stage. No, but I mean, I remember talking to the Edge there at that gig, and like, there was something very definite about, wow, these people seem to really know what they're doing. Having said that, it was only 3 weeks later, or 3 weeks before that, I met the whole lot of you in Grafton Street.
Mm.
And Bono says, we're going over to London. I just said, you're crazy, you know. Like, every second band's going over to London, they're already back, you know. So, I mean, like, you didn't have a plan. It was just, that was it. It just worked okay.
Yeah, there wasn't a master plan. Just, it just, like, we stumbled around, we asked people a lot of questions. And thankfully we got the answers.
Well, one of the great things that you did was that the A&R men came over. You didn't like it at all, so you took a real gamble going to the stadium for a Dublin-based band who'd never done anything sort of thing, and you almost sold out the stadium. And then it was there that after that Island Records signed. Yeah. So you must have felt really great that you sort of left that decision behind and said, right, okay, we'll go with this one. So you mean that you didn't go with the other record companies you could have easily gone with, like a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were offering singles, deals and all that, and we sort of felt that that wasn't what we wanted. And when Island Records offered us a deal, we turned it down, because it's like there's one album and three singles or something like that. And we said, we don't need this. We need time to develop. We're not really sure of our instruments, never mind anything else. You know, like we needed time, and we needed a company who were prepared to give us the time, and Island Records gave us that. They gave us the space, and... You know, but I mean, it was quite arrogant of a young band, you know, to sort of say, no, we're not going to sign that, we want more. And the record company said, yes, okay.
Mm. You know? Okay, well, listen, let's get back to something else then. You've mentioned twice already the band Sweet. So is there a story to go with this one here? Which one are we playing, Bowling and Blitz?
Yeah, no, it was the whole era. I just remember watching Top of the Pops and flying upstairs trying to, what's his name, Tucker, trying to copy what he used to do.
Right,
I mean,
too.
This is a complete diverse choice in music, and it's meant to be, because I'm not limited by anything. I listen to anything. I listen to the radio and whatever, and I'm not interested in what's hip or what's cool. You know, I listen to country music.
Well, in fact, the list of records that you gave us, you said you were going to bring, there's an awful lot of country stuff in.
Yeah.
Patsy Cline, right up,
right
down, I should say. With this one here, is this one of the types of songs you would have listened to? I presume you were one of the people definitely listened to the Transistor under the blankets.
Yeah, Radio Luxembourg. Yeah.
Is this one of the kind of things?
This is one of the kind of things that was
going on. Let's hear it. This is Ballroom Blitz, Sweet. Two with Larry Mullen from U2. We're going to play three more songs from the forthcoming U2 album, which is called The Joshua Tree. You just heard two choices of Larry's there, which is Ballroom Blitz by The Sweet, and that one there, The Vibrators, that's called Baby Baby. Let's take a break and then the 9 o'clock news. Well, I'm going to go to another track from the album by U2, which is called The Joshua Tree. What are they all laughing at out there?
The Joshua Tree.
Okay, well, anyway, this track I'm going to play is the first track on side two, and it's called Red Hill Mining Town. So that's the second one we've heard now tonight from The Joshua Tree, the album from U2. That's the first track inside two. It's called Red Hill Mining Town. Could you give us a bit about that one, Larry?
About that song?
Mm.
Well, I suppose that it's the lyrics you're talking about, really.
Yeah, like the miners' strike.
Well, actually, I had a discussion with my father. He was talking about the song because I gave him a copy of the album. And he was sort of saying, you know, it's very difficult to comment on the miners' strike and all that, and there are different people get different... When they hear Red Hill Mining Town and when they hear it's about the miners' strike, they immediately assume it's taking sides. And basically, what I interpret from Bono and from the song, it's not about that. It's about the struggle of a person who's on the picket line, who loses their job, and is struggling not only to get their job back, but also struggling with the relationship within that.
Yeah.
And I think that's basically, in a nutshell, what it's about. But, I don't like... discussing Bono's lyrics because they're his and they're very personal to him, and anything I say can only take away from him, so sorry Bono.
Okay, well listen Larry, there is one thing I want to clear up now at the moment, which is that, like I said last week, that you were coming in the programme, and it's one of the most looked forward to programmes, judging by the people I'm talking to, because like the letters, the phone calls, the bits and pieces that have come in. Now if you were to read out the names, if you were to read out the names that, would you please get Larry to read out all these names, which are 98% female incidentally, if you were to read them out, 100% female actually, if you were to read out the names, you'll be here till tomorrow. If you were to listen to all the poetry that's been sent in, the demos, everything else, you'll be here till next year, right? So you can have them all, we'll bring them all down. What happens with all that sort of thing when letters are sent in? There is somebody in the U2 office that looks after everything.
Yeah, what we set up is we've got a fan club, if you want to call it that, which is for people who want to get a magazine and get all the info and all that sort of stuff. And we've also got a section that people who want to know about records, what's been released and what hasn't been released, and things like people who from fanzines who want interviews and all that, and we deal with those through our own office. And basically any letter that's sent is dealt with either through the fan club or through our own office, and we try, and although it's impossible to reply personally, we try and pass all the letters on to members of the band.
Do you find that most people are understanding of the fact that it would simply be impossible to go through everything that's sent, even though like it's so heartfelt so much? I mean, some of these letters are like really...
No, it's very difficult, because a lot of the letters are, you know, are personal letters, and they've taken people a long time to write. And it's very hard just to sort of say, look, I can't reply to this letter. I don't want to get involved in somebody else's personal life. And some letters we've been receiving lately have been from people who have got serious hassles and are contemplating suicide and all sorts of things, which is really difficult to deal with, you know, because people putting their, you know, their life on the line and writing to you and telling you about it is hard, you know, because you can't get involved. You can't reply to them. And even some of the lads wanting to know what colour socks you wear. I mean, if you were to sit down and try and reply to them all, it would be impossible. So you just pick out ones that you feel that you can actually reply to. You know, and occasionally I write back if I get time.
I believe somebody sent Adam a lovely pair of socks there, isn't
it? That's right, yeah. People tend to send in socks and all that. But people sometimes are understanding and sometimes aren't. Like, there's in the new magazine, there's a guy writes in and says, I'm a big fan of the band. All I want is a personal reply and to meet the band. And he thinks he's the only one who's written in to say that.
Well, and like, there are 10,000 of them.
Right, you know, and there are lots of them. And, you know, it's just not possible. It's just not possible to meet all the people. And that's unfortunate, you know.
So, like, they can write to Sister Sister at Windmill Lane anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and all the letters are opened and replied to. And Cecilia looks after them.
Yeah.
And that's what she's employed for. She's, you know, she's there every day opening letters and going through
Well,
them.
What about the fact that you are a public property in that way? Do you find it's easier in Dublin? It's more, get up the air there, Larry, or as opposed to over in the States where they shake your hand and then expect a lot of things from you as well. Is it easier over here?
Yeah, it is a bit easier. In fact, the only problem is from foreigners coming over. A lot of people travel over to, like, take pictures of your house. However, I find Irish people are very, you know, they're casual, blasé about it. I don't get that much hassle. If I go into town, people will come up and, you know, either ask for your autograph or want to shake your hand, and that's cool, you know, that's great.
Yeah, in fact, that's funny you say, because a lot of foreigners do come over and want to know what you do. Like, I think they go for every connection and they come in here.
Yeah. No, it's all right at first, but it gets on your nerves. Like, there were two Italian women came over and walked up to my house and walked up to my door, and, like, they were old, they're, like, in the 30s, and they were, you know, they're teachers and they worked in some college, and they felt that they had the right to walk into my house and that I should be available to talk to them, you know, like, there and then. And, like, it was very hard to just say to them, look, no, I'm sorry, this is my home, it's private, and you can't come in here. If you want information, I'm not saying you can't have it, I'm saying you've got to do it in another way. If you write a letter, your questions will be answered, you know? And, you know, sometimes people want a PC, you know?
Yeah, because Morrissey was with us from the Smiths on the programme just a few weeks ago, and himself and Johnny Marr have moved down from Manchester now, down to London, because, I mean, he even said at one stage, like, you're walking on the street and somebody might want to give you a bop on the head, you know?
Yeah.
So, you would never think of leaving Dublin, though, on that level?
No, I mean,